Hello, this is Mary, and I'll be reading selections from the Decatur Herald and Review from Monday, December 16th, 2024. From the front page of the paper, local government, Decatur poised to hire lobbyists, $200,000 deal for voice in D.C., Springfield, by Brendan Moore. Decatur. Ahead of a new administration taking office in Washington, D.C., and a possibly turbulent state budget season in Springfield, the city of Decatur is expected to retain the services of a high-powered lobbying firm. The Decatur City Council on Monday will vote on a two-year, $200,000 contract with Mercury Public Affairs, a lobbying firm with reach in both the Illinois State House and on Capitol Hill. Per the terms of the agreement, the firm would be responsible for monitoring and advocating for budget allocations, building support for Decatur's legislative priorities, and assisting in the pursuit of state and federal grants. Generally speaking, I think the expectation is that a lobbyist brings much more money to the table than what they cost for the city, said Deputy City Manager John Kinseth. So we see it as a strategic investment. The firm's Illinois operation is headed by former U.S. Representative Sherry Bustos, a Democrat who represented Northwestern Illinois in Congress from 2013 to 2023. Kinseth said Bustos' recent legislative experience and D.C. ties were what initially attracted the city officials to the firm. The organization has also built up its Springfield connections in recent years, opening an office in Illinois' capital city and hiring experienced statehouse hands, such as former State Senator Toy Hutchinson, Democratic political consultant Zach Kautsky, and James Hartman, the former chief counsel to Illinois House Speaker Chris Welch. There is a direct Decatur connection, too. Michael Morthland, the senior vice president of Mercury Illinois office, is the son of Decatur city attorney Wendy Morthland. He also worked for the Decatur law firm Featherston, Gomer, Stocks, Flynn, and Eck from 2016 through 18. This is not the city's first foray into lobbying. Since 2016, the city and Macon County have split the cost of a $60,000 per year contract with transportation lobbyist Ann Schneider, whom city officials have credited for helping secure funds needed for major projects like the Brush College Road grade separation. And since 2022, the city has retained former Illinois Environmental Protection Agency Director Linda Bonnet on a $36,000 per year contract to consult on its long-term initiative to reduce siltation in Lake Decatur. Bonnet played a pivotal role in securing a $9.8 million U.S. Department of Agriculture grant last year for conservation efforts of private landowners within the Lake Decatur watershed who are not currently enrolled in other government cost share programs. Kinseth said that Mercury is a more full-service firm than the specialized services Bonnet and Schneider provide. The city is expected to retain the services of all of them. Other business. The council will consider three development agreements, including one granting a video gaming license to Restaurant Pool Hall Sticks on 3645 U.S. 36. Per the agreement, the owners of Sticks on 36 must invest at least $250,000 into the building, hold at least 50 amateur pool tournaments per year, and increase dining capacity by 50% within 12 months, among other conditions, in exchange for the video gaming license. It's the first development agreement of its kind inked since the council amended the city's liquor code in October. That change required a development agreement in place before a video gaming license is issued. We lost our pool hall during COVID, Kinseth said. And so Styx on 36 is a replacement of that, and they have other unique aspects of their business that complement the city of Decatur. The council will also consider a development agreement that would authorize a sales tax rebate for KC Fines, an overstock and discount retailer that opened earlier this year in the former Ace Hardware space at 2809 North Main Street. The retailer also offers space for more than 100 local vendors to sell antiques and handcrafted goods. Under the proposed agreement, the city would rebate 90% of the sales taxes collected for the first 3 years, 75% in the fourth year, and 50% in the fifth year. This would help the developers recoup some of the $275,000 building remodel costs that were incurred. The third agreement on the consent agenda would change the zoning of the former Temple B'nai Abraham Synagogue at 1326 West El Dorado Street from B1 to a planned development district. The building's owners, Brian and Jody Suey, are seeking to renovate the building for use as a private event space, such as for weddings, receptions, and fundraisers. The renovations will happen in phases, and at least at the beginning, events will be limited to fewer than 100 people. Also from the front page of today's paper, a Christmas story. Bloomington family set on seeing 100 Santas this Christmas season. By Caitlin Klapik, Pantograph.com. Bloomington. When Lucas Miles was deployed to Iraq with the Illinois National Guard in 2019, he missed a year of teaching his third graders at Cedar Ridge Elementary in Bloomington. But more importantly, he missed Christmas with his family. For the Miles family, Christmas has always been an important holiday. However, Lucas Miles' service in Iraq and the pandemic upon his return in 2020 prevented him from taking his two kids to see Santa with his wife. "I've always been a big fan of Christmas, ever since I was born," said 8-year-old Bennett Miles. His 6-year-old sister, Merritt, added her favorite part about Christmas is seeing a whole bunch of Santas. This year, the family has a goal to see 100 Santas before the Christmas season is over. So far, they have seen 52. After Lucas Miles returned from Iraq, he was able to take his children to see maybe 2 Santas in 2020, he said, with Christmas in 2021 being similar because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Things picked up last year when Lucas Miles and the kids saw 89 Santas together. Merritt, though, broke the record with 91 total, seeing 2 additional Santas over her older brother. "I'm not totally sure how that happened," Lucas Miles said. "I was like, oh man, maybe we can see 100. The family has traveled far and wide to meet their goal, going to Chicago, St. Louis, Decatur, and Springfield. Usually the Miles family looks to social media to discover where Santa will be. But Lucas Miles noted that he has also seen where to find Santa articles in the Pantograph. "I guess this is like a Clark Griswold National Lampoon Christmas Vacation," Lucas said, referring to the famous film, with a laugh. He spoke about 2019, when he had 3 or 4 weeks between when the school year ended and when he was deployed to Iraq. In that limited time period, the family visited the East Coast, including New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania, before coming back to Bloomington Normal for a couple of days, then heading to the Ozarks and back home, before venturing west again, hitting the Dakotas, Montana, and Wyoming, hoping to squeeze in some family time before Lucas Miles left. "So we clipped off half the states in the Union in about a 3-week span, It just kind of leads into going nuts with Santa, Lucas Miles said. Go big or go home. Though the family sees dozens of Santas each year, both kids say they generally keep their wish list the same for each visit. This year, Bennett is wishing for Star Wars cards, violin books, and a real-life lightsaber, although his dad says he's not sure if the North Pole is currently making those. I've been training with fake lightsabers, Bennett pleaded. That's true, you're ready to go, his dad responded. Sister Merritt is wishing for a guitar, Pokemon cards, Star Wars cards, and books. The family started seeing Santa during the last weekend of July, getting a head start, but the majority of their Santa seeing happens in November and December. Eventually, we'll have to dial it back, I'm sure. But while the going's, I guess, good, let's go nuts, Lucas Miles said. Turning to page 3, the Life section. Greater Chicago's Black Cowboys, Riding on Tradition. Generations passed down rodeoing knowledge, values brought from the South. By Tiffany Arnold, Chicago Tribune. At 85 years old, Calvin White didn't let his age slow him down while riding his horse speedily between 6 tall stake poles during the pole-bending competition at the Brown Family Ranch's annual rodeo this fall in Gary, Indiana. In this competition, the rider with the fastest time wins, and White placed 3rd. Of the many Black men and women riding horses in the region, White is among the riders who have been on horseback all of their lives, and he has no plans to stop riding anytime soon. Like most cowboys and cowgirls at the Gary event, White says rodeoing and horses are a way of life. Horseback riding isn't uncommon in this part of the Midwest. Riders in the nooks of northwest Indiana board and ride on ranches region-wide, including Merrillville, Gary, Sucklerville, Dyer, and Hobart. The cowboys who hail from Chicago say being on a ranch is a reprieve from city life. There's a different feeling to riding in the rural parts of Chicagoland and northwest Indiana, they say, adding that being a cowboy is a peaceful lifestyle. For many, this is part of their heritage, and for others, it's a trail they've blazed themselves. Yet all of the region's Black cowboys agree they have a duty to keep the legacy going for the next generation. White, who lives in Gary, was originally a cowboy from Monticello, Arkansas. Born in 1939, he trained as a carpenter, and in 1964, like millions of other Black Americans during the Great Migration, he migrated north in search of work. At the time, there were no jobs in the South, he said. In Arkansas, horse riding was an everyday activity. For White, who lived near horse owners of different backgrounds, and whose uncle helped teach him about horses. As a young man, White would give a mile-long wagon rides to those who sat by his family home. Up the road from us there was a man with a brother from Louisiana, White said. He'd bring his horses up to his brother's. We'd go up there on horses and break them in. We broke them and worked them. Breaking in a horse is the process of training it to be ridden. Like many of his peers who headed north during that era, White carried the horse-owning tradition and lifestyle with him. That's what we did down there. Rodeo, ride horses, break horses, White said. My mother, everybody rode horses. It was more horse riders back then, when my mother grew up, than when I grew up. They rode horses back then like cars. White was born shortly after an era where renowned Black cowboys such as Bill Pickett, Bass Reeves, and Nat Love roamed the U.S. Pickett is believed to be the originator of bulldogging, an event where riders jump off horseback to wrestle cattle to the ground. Reeves was also one of the first Black U.S. Marshals, and Love wrote stories of his life in the Old West. Today, modern Black cowboys such as White, along with Kent Walker and others, hold on to the history of rodeo and horsemanship in the Chicago region. They have taken it upon themselves to instill this aspect of Black American culture in their families and communities. Chicagoan Tommy O'Penson Jr., 24, was taught by legendary Chicago cowboy Murdoch, who is known as the man with no first name, and who founded the Broken Arrow Horseback Riding Club in 1989. Murdoch introduced us to horseback riding. I wanted to pass it down, to keep it going in the chain, O'Penson said of the tradition. Then when I have kids, my kids can do it. I understood how important it was, 100%. One big thing is us doing it together. That's how Murdoch and I bond together. Many of the cowboys and cowgirls in the region come from a family of horse riders. Rider Camille Fuller, 24, of Gary, said her grandfather Philip Fuller was a cowboy in the area. He would bring his grandchildren to his barn, and they would watch as he tended his horses. Kent Walker was born in Hamilton, Georgia. His family relocated to Northwest Indiana after his father got a job in a mill. In Georgia, Walker rode horses most of his life. In 1985, he became a semi-pro rodeo performer up north. I got on a horse when I was 3. I'm 65 now, said Walker, who lives in Gary. Back in the day, Black people down in the country had horses, and they used to ride their horses after they worked them all day in the fields. They made their enjoyment out on the weekend and had different events. That's how they used to compete with their horses, and that's how I got hooked on it. After being raised around horse riding, Walker brought up his children in the same environment. His son, Jeray Walker, who lives in Arizona, said being back in Indiana for the rodeo was like being at a family reunion. I'm seeing family friends I haven't seen since I was 10 or 11. Now I'm 41, Jeray Walker said. At the Brown Ranch, Devontae Ware, 26, passed by on a small, tall, smoky gray horse. Ware's uncle, Carlos Pedraza, said the horse is a quarter horse. Pedraza's uncle Buck, who grew up on a horse farm, gave the Chicago family its cowboy legacy, Pedraza said. Ware, Pedraza, and their family now tour rodeos across the U.S. The cowboy tradition is also passed on through values, many cowboys said, especially the sentiment that hard work and repetitiveness of horse ownership taught them patience, respect, and maturity. They also said it put them on a positive path in life. The number of Black cowboys in the region is hard to pinpoint. Community members say it could be upward of 200. But the public Facebook group for Murdoch's Broken Arrow Horseback Riding Club has more than 4,000 members. For Black cowboys, there is an understanding that the love for horsemanship must be passed down to other generations. The Brown Family Ranch's rodeo started 9 years ago as an annual bonfire with friends and evolved into a community-wide rodeo in Gary. One of my buddies said, "Why don't you do a speed and accuracy challenge?" So we had our first rodeo in 2021, ranch owner Chris Brown said. Competitions include events such as barrel racing, where a rider quickly races around barrels in a pattern. Nakesia Brown, Chris's wife, said rodeoing can provide opportunities for young people beyond competitions. "You can get scholarships for these things," she said, and the Brown family offers its own scholarship for college students. Pedraza said he is passing on his knowledge to up-and-coming cowboys and cowgirls, especially things he learned from his uncle. "I was taught by some of the best," Pedraza said. "It was second nature to me because I was taught from when we were kids." And now he is continuing the tradition. On page 5, National News, "Nursing Homes to Trump, Cancel Staffing Mandate," by Jordan Rao, KFF Health News. COVID's rampage through the country's nursing homes killed more than 172,000 residents and spurred the biggest industry reform in decades. a mandate that homes employ a minimum number of nurses. But with President-elect Donald Trump's return to the White House, the industry is ramping up pressure to kill that requirement before it takes effect, leaving thousands of residents in homes too short-staffed to provide proper care. The nursing home industry has been marshaling opposition for months among congressional Republicans and some Democrats to overrule the Biden administration's mandate. Two industry groups, the American Healthcare Association and Leading Age, have sued to overturn the regulation, and 20 Republican state attorneys general have filed their own challenge. Consumer advocates, industry officials, and independent researchers agree that the incoming administration is likely to rescind the rule, given the first Trump administration's patience over paperwork campaign to remove unnecessary, obsolete, or excessively burdensome health regulations on hospitals and other health care providers. Among other things, Trump aided the agency by easing fines against homes that had been cited for poor care. The Trump administration has proven itself really eager to reverse overreaching regulations, said Linda Couch, senior vice president for policy and advocacy at Leading Age, which represents nonprofit elder care providers. We think it's got a pretty good chance of being repealed, and we hope so. Issued in April, the staffing regulation requires nursing homes to have registered nurses on site around the clock, something the industry has endorsed, and to maintain minimum numbers of nurses and aides. 4 in 5 homes would have to increase staffing. The requirements would be phased in starting in May 2026. Even before the election, many experts and activists had doubts that the rules would be effectively enforced, given the poor results in states that have imposed their own minimums. In New York, California, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts, states with the most robust requirements, many homes remain below the legal staffing levels. Governors have given many homes reprieves, and other homes have found that paying penalties costs less than the actual increase in payroll for additional staff. The federal government estimates the average annual cost over a decade to meet the Biden mandate would be $4.3 billion a year, a 2% increase in expenses. Though the changes do not include increases in federal Medicare or Medicaid payments. Advocate groups for nursing home residents, who had criticized the Biden administration rule for not requiring even higher staffing levels, have since pivoted and are trying to protect it. The Trump transition team did not respond to a request for comment. The Department of Health and Human Services did not respond to requests for comment, but in a court filing it argued that nursing homes should be able to reach the required staffing levels. The quality of care in the nation's 15,000 nursing homes and the lack of adequate staffing for their 1.2 million residents has been a concern for decades. Inspection reports continue to find homes leaving residents lying in their own feces, suffering severe bed sores and falls, contracting infections, choking on food while unattended, or ending up back in a hospital for preventable reasons. Some nursing homes overuse psychotropic medications to pacify residents because they do not have enough workers to attend to them. The nursing home industry says many homes cannot afford to increase their workforces, and that even if they could, there is a scarcity of trained nurses, and not enough people willing to work as aides for an average of $19 an hour. A registered nurse earns $40 an hour on average in a nursing home, less than what they could make at a hospital, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The Biden administration noted in its court filing it was planning to spend $75 million to recruit and train more workers, and that there were more than 100,000 workers who left nursing homes during the pandemic and could be lured back if salaries and working conditions were better. Turning to page 6 with the sports news, win then in. Sunday's games in the NFL. Local teams in the area. Results include Bills 48, Lions 42. Josh Allen ran for 2 scores in the first quarter and threw 2 touchdown passes in the second half, helping visiting Buffalo snap Detroit's franchise record 11-game winning streak. The Lions remain in first place in the NFC Central, but depending on tonight's game between the Vikings and the Bears, there may be a first-place tie with Minnesota. The Broncos, 31, Indianapolis Colts, 13. Linebacker Nick Benito foiled a trick play by stepping in front of quarterback Anthony Richardson and hijacking the lateral pass before racing 50 yards for a touchdown that sealed Denver's home victory over Indianapolis. Packers 30, Seahawks 13. Jordan Love threw 2 touchdown passes to Romeo Doubs, and visiting Green Bay ended Seattle's 4-game winning streak. Josh Jacobs ran for 94 yards and a touchdown. Turning to the front page, Environment. Energy projects get Trump jolt, by Matthew Daly, Associated Press. President-elect Donald Trump promised expedited federal permits for energy projects and other construction worth more than $1 billion. Like other Trump plans, the idea is likely to run into regulatory and legislative hurdles, including a landmark law that requires federal agencies to consider the environmental impact before deciding on major projects. In a post on his Truth Social site Tuesday, Trump said anyone making a billion-dollar investment in the United States will receive fully expedited approvals and permits, including, but in no way limited to, all environmental approvals. Get ready to rock, he added. While Trump did not specify who would be eligible for accelerated approval, dozens of energy projects proposed nationwide, from natural gas pipelines and export terminals to solar farms and offshore wind turbines, meet the billion-dollar criteria. Environmental groups slammed the proposal, calling it illegal on its face and a clear violation of the National Environmental Policy Act, a 54-year-old law that requires federal agencies to study the potential environmental impact of proposed actions and consider alternatives. Trump is unabashedly and literally offering to sell out America to the highest corporate bidder, said Lena Moffitt, executive director of Evergreen Action, an environmental group. She said the plan was obviously illegal and another example of Trump putting special interests and corporate polluters in the driver's seat, which would result in more pollution, higher costs, and fewer energy choices for the American people. Alexandra Adams of the Natural Resources Defense Council said Trump should be careful what he wishes for. What if someone wants to build a waste incinerator next to Mar-a-Lago or a coal mine next to Bedminster Golf Course? He asked, referring to Trump's Florida home and New Jersey golf club, respectively. There's a reason Congress requires the government to take a hard look at community impacts to make sure we don't greenlight projects that do more harm than good. Cheerleading on social media doesn't change that reality, Adams said. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review from Monday, December 16th, 2024. Please stay tuned.